Well, tonight on Coast to Coast, of course, we are honoring six Coast to Coast guests who have passed on, six special people. The next one, of course, was dear to our hearts, David Flynn. He was a regular contributor on Coast to Coast, and I'll be talking to him in just a moment from an episode from 2008. It's hard to believe how much time has passed with these incredible people. So many of them, too. We went through an entire list of people, and some recent ones have passed on. Ed Grimsley, of course, expert in night vision goggles and UFOs, and gosh, just so many people. Okay, we'll come back in a moment and more with David Flynn on Coast to Coast AM. Well, since 1993, David Flynn had posted original and groundbreaking research of ancient mysteries, illuminated fraternities, end-time biblical prophecy, on his famous Watcher website. David's research has been published and referenced by numerous best-selling authors, books, and magazines all around the world. He was quite a guest. Here's David Flynn.
The story tonight that we're going to talk with David about for this hour happens to do with the apparent discovery of a vast prehistoric works built by giants geoglyphs, and he's with us now. David, how are you?
Good, George. Oh, good evening. It's great to talk to you.
Likewise. Tell me about this discovery. Where is this?
Well, it's really a unique situation. It's centered around Lake Titicaca in Bolivia. And Lake Titicaca actually is bordering on Peru and Bolivia at the same time. But this swath of geoglyphs that I found way back in August of last year actually covers such a vast territory and is so dense that I really couldn't believe my eyes when I was looking at it. It's nearly 20,000 square miles of densely saturated tapestry over every topographical feature, hills, mountains, various shapes and forms, and it just boggles the mind.
20,000 square miles?
That's about the rough estimate that I have.
How did you discover this?
Well, I was, you know, doing the same sort of research that I've been doing for almost 15 years, and you have to avail yourself of Google Earth. I mean, it's such an incredible tool.
True.
And lately, they've been upgrading with very high-res images some of the surface of the globe. And I think it's QuickBird Satellite from the Bell Aerospace Technologies Corporation. That's where Google gets some of their most high-res images. And those had been placed over Lake Titicaca last year, I think early last year, and I hadn't actually encountered them until August. And I'd actually been and visited Tiwanaku, which is that incredibly, you know, mystical city that's 12 miles south of Lake Titicaca. And I hadn't seen that sort of resolution. But this time I went and I saw it was down to 5 meters per pixel. And all these geoglyphs kind of showed up.
David, tell us your definition of geoglyph. What does that mean?
Well, they're massive shapes and patterns that have been put into the ground. Usually for a ritualistic or religious purpose by an ancient culture, there's ideas. I think the most commonly held one, the one that most people would think of when they're thinking of the geoglyphs, is the Nazca Lines in Peru.
Right, right, yeah.
Off the desert, you know, off the Pacific coast there. And there's other ones in Australia, giant men. In England, even, there's the Great Rude Man, just a chalk outline, the horses there. Those are geoglyphs. They're usually carved into the earth. These that are around Lake Titicaca are all, they're not anthropomorphic. They're almost like abstract art. And there's an incredible undertaking that actually went into these things. You look in some areas, almost 200 miles south of Lake Titicaca, for example, on this flat plain with these hills that kind of rise up out of the sediment of the valley, which, by the way, is almost 13,000 feet above sea level. You'll see etches and labyrinth shapes that are in these hills, and it's mostly bedrock, which is poking out of the sediment, that you could fit buses into and railroad cars into. And it's labyrinth design next to labyrinth design, wall after wall after wall. You can take a hill that's, you can say maybe 10 miles worth of hills in a line, and you'll find these lines so densely packed that in that amount of area, you actually have a line, if you put it all together, the mass of Hadrian's Wall that would cross Britain. And I estimate the actual amount of mass that has gone into these structures to exceed any that actually exist in the ancient world.
Why are we speculating that they might have been built by giants?
Well, that's the part that really blew my mind when I was looking at it, because I understand the geology of the area, and when I started seeing these things, I thought, you know, I'm going to get as many resources on, and books on the geology and the history as I can find. And I found Arthur Ponansky's books, and he actually studied Tiwanaku, the city that was buried at that altiplano below Lake Titicaca. He studied it for almost 25 years. And in the 1920s, I think, is when he was in Bolivia looking at this thing, he wrote volumes of work on it. H.S. Bellany, he wrote later about the actual complex of this area. And all these works are astounding. Everything they have to say is incredible. They're talking about subterranean roads that the conquistadors, the Spanish, found when they actually encountered the Inca. They're talking about cities that have maybe three or four layers of incumbent sediment on them that was actually placed during the Pleistocene, which is almost 13,000 years ago, which demarks the Pleistocene from the Holocene, which we live in now, the geologic age. And then you go to the maps and you look at the topography of the area, and you can see that the area is indeed so high up that there really isn't any way to live there today in mass numbers. And looking at the Nazca lines as the closest analog, researchers know that those things were built, and they're vast, and they cover, you know, many, many miles, but they're nothing compared to Tiwanaku and around Lake Titicaca. But these things took hundreds of years to produce, thousands of people to put them there, and they're at a relatively low area. They're pretty close to sea level near Lake Titicaca, where the actual geoglyphs are. These things are so high up that if you just visit them and you go to maybe the La Paz hotels, which is the actual capital of Bolivia, they'll give you oxygen to get you through the night so you don't get altitude.
Jeez. What would you estimate these giants to be? How high do you think, how tall do you think they were?
Well, David Hatchett Childress actually went to the La Paz Museum and saw skulls, fossilized skulls that were exhumed from around Tiwanaku. And this is exactly right in the center of the geoglyph tapestry, I guess I could call it. And these skulls were all misshapen, elongated. They had up to three times the cranial capacity of modern man. And being fossilized, too, you can place these things back. I don't think they were carbon dated, but you can place these things back in the strata that they were found. And apparently the strata that they were found in goes all the way back to the end of the Pleistocene Age also. And so when Ponansky was writing about this area, he actually calibrated the age of that city to be almost 17,000 years ago. And he did this by actually aligning 17,000. And he aligned the Kalasesaya temple to the obliquity of the ecliptic, which changes over, you know, quite a few thousand years at a time. It's not the same thing as precession, but he wasn't understood. Most of the researchers of the area didn't realize that the Inca hadn't built these things. They didn't claim to build them. The Spanish chroniclers, who weren't really that open to what the Inca had to say, only recorded what the myths and legends of the surviving Inca, who didn't run away from them into the hills and into the jungle, had told them. And so the information is incredibly scant, and I think that adds to the mystery, too, that these things could exist in modern times and have never been talked about, haven't even been realized, and yet they're still there.
Is there a message in these geoglyphs?
There is something, I think. There's a corollary, I believe, that is actually incredibly complex, and that is, we know that the Inca possessed no written language, and the Inca civilization only lasted for maybe 100 years, but they inherited many other cultures and many other traditions and legends and technologies, and they had a form of writing that now is actually being studied more closely, and it's called quipus. It's quipus. Rope. It's knotted rope. And when you lay this stuff out, they found stuff in Peru and in around Bolivia that goes back to 2000 BC. And the Inca, of course, you know, living only 100 years, the civilization being only 100 years, they only existed from like 1400 to 1500 when the Spanish came. But they actually inherited this system from incredible antiquity. And it's able to record legends and myths, crop data, census data, war data. And they're only now finding out that this has actually been recorded in this way, that it actually has this power to keep this much information. Some of these geoglyphs look incredibly similar to the knotted rope system of Quipus. In fact, I actually incorporated one of them in the article. And if you look closely, you can see these varying sorts of excised like ditches in solid bedrock in these hills, and they seem to correspond to the sort of segments and sequences of the Quipus. And so there very may well be a message not unlike the Quipus in these rocks. And speaking of the giants that put them there, the thing that really makes me believe this is the legends that the Inca related themselves, that they inherited from, of course, the Tawari before them, which is another tribe name, that lived like maybe 300 years before that, and then other civilizations that lived before them, which they all attested to. And that is that Tiwanaku itself was built by the giants, created by their creation god named Viracocha. And Viracocha is really similar to a lot of the more familiar Middle Eastern gods of creation. His name actually means white foam or foam of the sea. I think he's really closely related to this idea of the gods of creation for the Greeks, the serpent god of the heavens, Tiamat and Titan and that sort of thing. And I think what that is referring to is the Milky Way, an actual foam-like, serpent-like, but also sea-like figure in the sky. And that's exactly what the Inca talk about, that the warriors of Viracocha came down to the earth and they built this city, and that they actually created these giants that were subsequently destroyed because of their wickedness. And then there was a second creation by Viracocha, according to the Inca legends, where he created the first two people. And interestingly enough, that was in the center of Lake Titicaca. And they propagated civilization itself from that point around the earth. It fits into the Zeptepi of the Egyptians. It fits into where you actually look at the Sumerian kings list and the Egyptian kings list, and their talk about the Necheru and the other primary gods of their civilization ruling first, and then later on the Subsuhoro, the ones that follow Horus. And then after that, the god kings and the just plain human beings.
Hey, David, with all this that's been going on, I also wanted to check in with you on Cydonia. I haven't heard much, not even from Richard, about what might be going on there. Has everyone, given up?
No. In fact, I think he has some very interesting things up his sleeve. And I feel a little bit bad. I was really hoping that I could maybe collaborate with him, and I think that may be the plan still, but I was a little bit afraid of getting scooped, because this stuff is so easy to find on Google Earth, and they're always putting more high-res images every day on Google. I wanted it to get out there. I wanted to actually find some people on the ground in Bolivia to look at this. Maybe brush up on my Spanish, but to actually get there on the ground and study this sort of thing. But I'd actually talked to Richard about these things and about the remote sensing of it all, and because he is one of the experts on, looking at images from space, satellites. And he said there's incredible merit to it. And there is some very, very interesting connections between his research and this find. And so I'm not going to say any more about that.
I knew he was up to something. I knew he was up to something. Tell me, what's been going on with your book, Cydonia and the Mystery of Mars? Is still in print?
Well, there's a couple floating around. Tom Horn, thanks to him, this article got out, and he has a couple. We may go and have it reprinted. I'm working on another book, too, with him, and it's called Temple at the Center of Time. And it's kind of why I ended up looking at Tiwanaku again. It has a lot to do with Isaac Newton's works that weren't published and are just coming out, and some that have been out but people aren't aware of. And his work on some of the time and space dimensional sort of qualities of the Temple of Jerusalem. And,
did you see yesterday a Japanese scientist out at Kobe University now believe that there is a planet X in the solar system, almost like Zechariah Sitchin's Planet X, the 12th Planet book?
I was really taken aback. It was so matter of fact. I can't believe it's just out there like that. And people have been clamoring to try to bring, some sort of academic backing behind this. And now it's just out there like, no big deal. And I've been following that story for quite a few years, especially thanks to you. You've kept me
interested. It's a fascinating story.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, if the only difference I've seen in what the COBE researchers pointed out last night and what Sitchin has reported on from the Sumerian tablets that he has investigated is the orbit of this thing, because Sitchin says it's a 3,600-year elliptical orbit. The COBE University researchers say it's a 1,000-year elliptical orbit. They're off by a little bit. It's still a great story.
Oh, yeah, and it's a little ominous, too, because they're changing the statistics all the time, and, it's such a dynamic sort of thing. You got to really pay attention to what's being said and what's not being said, I think.
Too. I'll be amazed if the Japanese researchers say, oh, we're wrong, it's about a 3,600-year elliptical orbit.
Or it's only going to take a couple years to get here.
What a sad story, too. David Flynn died at the age of only 49 years old. That's it. And like you just heard, he got involved in the pyramids on Cydonia and other kinds of incredible works. One of his books was a great seller, of course. It was the one I mentioned, Cydonia, The Secret Chronicles of Mars. But he also wrote Temple at the Center of Time and did very well. Let's go to Bernie in Chicago, Illinois. Hey, Bernie, thanks for calling.
George, thanks for taking my phone call. Great, great show. Dave was a great guy.
Oh, my God.
He was prevalent, very relevant. And I don't, this is probably something you don't know, your listeners don't know. In the discovery of Amber, which was just about 800 miles, 790 miles outside of the slim area of Romberg, a region of Tobin, South America. In the Zaslo area outside of Horay, which is an aspectual area, a region of Prince 790, the ticket. What are your thoughts on that?
On what?
On the discovery of Amber.
I really don't have any thoughts on that at all. All I can tell you is David Flynn, when he was doing his work and research, was one of the best, absolutely one of the best, and he will be missed. And one of our next guests, of course, you're going to know his name when I tell you. He lived a pretty good life. He was one of the astronauts on Apollo 14, just a super guy, Edgar Mitchell. He believed in extraterrestrial life. He would tell me every so often that we're being visited. He did tell me once, he said, George, I've never seen extraterrestrials. I've never seen a UFO, but I can tell you this, and I can tell you this directly. We are being visited, and I've been told that by a number of people high up. So that's what we're going to do. We're going to go in with Edgar Mitchell next on Coast to Coast. There's a number of other guests that have passed on that will join us. Now, I'm getting lots of emails from folks reminiscing about other guests who have died, like Glenn Kimball and so many others. We have done some of them, and we will do more of those as time permits, of course. I'd like to do two of these kinds of programs a year. Just to pay homage to these incredible people who brought us so much information. So up next, we'll be talking about Edgar Mitchell right here on Coast to Coast AM and some of his incredible work. We'll be back. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Dr. Edgar Mitchell was the sixth man to walk on the moon. He did that in 1971. Great Coast to Coast guest. I will always remember the day I met him at a UFO conference in Washington, D.C. Just an amazing guy. He passed away recently at the age of 85 years old. His academic background included a Bachelor of Science degree in Industrial Management from Carnegie Mellon University, a Bachelor of Science from the U.S. Naval Postgraduate School, a Doctor of Science in Aeronautics and Astronautics from MIT, and he was a staunch believer that this planet was being visited by extraterrestrials.
Edgar, always a pleasure, my friend. How are you?
Thank you, George. Nice to be with you this morning.
Likewise, likewise. You've been busy lately since we last talked some time ago.
I stay pretty busy. A lot going on.
Well, I had an opportunity to meet Buzz Aldrin. I was on Larry King's show several weeks ago, and what a delightful guy. He's as tough now as he probably was then, Edgar.
Well, I think it's He does, all right.
He is. Does not believe in extraterrestrials at all. Did you ever talk with him about that?
Just briefly. I've talked with all the fellows about what they saw in space, but no, none of us have seen that firsthand experience, at least through the Apollo program. Nothing in space that was not subsequently validated or understood.
Edgar, though, we're going to talk about a lot of your new work tonight. I wanted to just review a little bit Apollo 14 astronaut, some incredible things. I get upset sometimes when people claim that we did not go to the moon. Do you get that much, Edgar, whenever you're out or speaking? Do people actually ask you?
Well, it comes up occasionally, but I point out also, and it's good to point out here, there's over 6.5 billion people on this Earth right now, and half of them weren't born when we went to the moon. So the younger group may properly have doubts because they weren't there to listen to all of it. My standard answer when people bring it up, which isn't very often, you really think the Soviets would have let us get away with this? Because it was a race to the moon, and we won, but and the Soviets knew exactly what we were doing all the time. They simply wouldn't have let it be a hoax and not blow the whistle. So it's really nonsensical. And the evidence is overwhelming that we did just what we said we did. And the equipment's still there, and the laser reflectors are still there. You can do it any day of the week if you have the right laser and astronomy and the telescope. You can confirm exactly where it is. So all the evidence is there. You just have to look.
Are you disappointed that we didn't continue the manned moon missions?
As a scientist, yes. None of the scientists thought that we were ready to quit because we just got started. But the public was saying, oh, ho-hum, been there, done that, and we did what John Kennedy wanted to do, so what's new? That's kind of a short-sighted view, unfortunately, but that's what it is.
You know, 3 years ago when you were last on the program, we talked about the possibilities of extraterrestrial life, and I share your views at that time. Of course, we talked about the possibility of visitation and what had happened on this planet a long time ago. Do you still believe that? You haven't changed your mind that you believe that we have been visited?
Oh, no. The evidence is very, very strong. My disclaimer is I have no firsthand experience. All of my experience comes from what I call the old-timers who were around before looking at these things before I was and before the modern period. And I had the good fortune to be briefed by some of them. Most of them, nearly all of them, as far as I know now, deceased. But and I furthermore had it confirmed for me by a very high-level officer that was involved. So all I can say is I had no first-hand experience, but yes, the evidence is overwhelming, as far as I'm concerned, that we have been visited.
Edgar, when Neil Armstrong and Buzz were on the moon with Apollo 11, there are some who have always said that they saw craft on the moon, extraterrestrial craft. Of course, Buzz denies it. Neil, of course, really has never talked about that at all, doesn't talk much about anything, really. He's not as available as other astronauts have been. Did you ever hear any scuttlebutt about that at all?
Well, of course, you hear the scuttlebutt about it, but it's not from our guys. It's manufactured out in the great unwashed public out there.
What about structures on the moon? Nothing like that.
I can speak directly to that because there was a claim that the structures were mirrored in my visor.
Okay, so
it's my visor and Alan Bean's visor, and that simply is not true.
So at least in the areas that our astronauts landed, we're talking about it was just the old moon.
That is exactly right. I do not doubt or will not deny that the possibility exists that there might be alien bases at some point put on the moon, but as far as I can tell from everything I've seen, that is not true, and we don't have the evidence of it if it's true.
You know, Edgar, I always thought also it could be possible that humankind lived millions and millions of years ago, in that if there was ever any evidence on the moon of something past, it might have been us, that we might have visited the moon a long, long time ago. Did you ever think about that?
Well, I thought about that. I don't find that very credible or appealing. I think we do have a pretty good understanding of our past history. Now, we could be wrong. There's a lot of other things are wrong, too, about our knowledge base. But I don't think that was wrong.
When you and I first talked, I was doing my local show in St. Louis. Your book, The Way of the Explorer, had just come out. An incredible story of how you started to experiment with the mind. Tell us a little bit about that and what pushed you in that direction. So much more than your journey now, I think, is possibly even more exciting than even when you went to the moon.
Well, thank you. What got me started was just reading science literature, and particularly the work of the early parapsychologist who did experiments and insisted that they were finding a phenomenon that we couldn't explain, what we now call our intuitive level, and which, by the way, just to set the record straight, seems pretty well explained and within quantum physics and modern understanding of the structure. But at that time, it certainly was not. And the intrigue for me was that if these guys are right, if the experimental evidence is correct and is replicated, then we in science are absolutely wrong in insisting that there's no such thing. And because based upon Newtonian physics, you don't have an explanation for it. Well, that's exactly true. In Newtonian physics, you don't have an explanation for it. But in quantum physics, we do. And the modern evidence is overwhelming. There's not any question that anybody wants to look and study the evidence as to what the answer is.
In the years that have come and gone, have we found more scientific proof of what you've been talking about for so long?
Well, it's not. The answer is more. Yes. If you use the probability approach, statistical approach, which is used in all science about things, the probabilities are completely off the chart that the experiments show precisely what we say they show. And so most of us don't waste any time with that anymore, trying to prove the existence of the intuitive or quantum faculty. It's there. But understanding all of the mechanizations and how brain-mind works in this area, that's the new area. And the neurophysiologists are in on it now. We're making a great deal of headway. I mean, it's no longer for anyone that's really studied and wants to look at the phone. It's not a mystery anymore. It's just we don't know all the details.
You developed a model years ago called the dyadic model of human consciousness. Has that model stayed the same? Has it changed at all?
Yes, it's stayed the same. It's correct. Like I say, it's not complete in that we don't have all the answers, but it is correct as far as it goes. And simply stated for our listeners, which is not, it's not hard to state it, begin just with the notion that energy and matter is not quite enough to explain our existence and how we know about it. That you have to have a basic mechanism in physics that explains information. Now, information theory has grown up here in the last few years to become quite an important part of the way we look at nature. And basic information theory, although it began in the late 40s, has matured, and we now understand quantum information, which we did not at that point in time. Go ahead.
Understand you're on a wonderful documentary with directed and produced by Ron Howard. And
You're talking about this new one, The Shadow of the Moon?
Yeah.
Yeah, Ron's involved with that. And it's just premiered in New York. It premiered last week, last Friday. My voice is starting to crack on me here, George. Sorry.
Hold on, Edgar. You've got 2.5 hours to go.
A cup of tea here.
That's right. You know what? I always find that I've got a little tea. I put some honey in it right before I go on the air all the time, and it just kind of soothes you.
Because throat.
Yeah, it really can. And a little bit later on, we're going to be taking phone calls, so we'll give you a little relief there.
Okay, good.
Ed Mitchell, Apollo14.com is Dr. Mitchell's website. It's linked up at coasttocoastam.com, and I would invite all of you to go take a look at some of the incredible things he has done. You know, on this program, we have talked in the past about the institute that he founded called the Institute of Noetic Sciences that really dives into the nature of consciousness and how it relates to space. And we'll talk with him more about that. We'll also get into those views that Dr. Mitchell believes we have been visited by extraterrestrials, though like he said, he doesn't have the firsthand eyewitness account himself. He believes in the people who have told him this. We'll talk about that. I don't know if he can reveal the names of everyone, but we'll see what he's got. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. You know, I was 20 years old, about ready in a few months after that to turn 21 when Apollo 14 with Dr. Mitchell and Alan Shepard, of course, being the first American to go into space when they landed on the moon, 20 to 21 years old. And, you know, every time I talk with Dr. Edgar Mitchell, I still feel like kid, even though I wasn't a kid at 20 years old, because of the wonders. You just sit back and imagine this, to be talking to someone who actually was on the moon. I mean, you look at the moon, the full moon we just had a few weeks ago. It's wondrous. It's the mysteries of this universe. I'm looking forward to this. And we'll talk a little bit more about extraterrestrial life in the next hour. We'll get into his new work, The View from Space. Well, I might have a little surprise for you with Dr. Mitchell in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie with Dr. Edgar Mitchell. Edgar, was the heart thumping that February day in 1971 when you walked on the moon?
Yes, as a matter of fact, the medics told me it was. I was too busy doing other things to worry about it, but yes, they said so.
Did you and Alan have any problems or technical problems while you were there?
Any kind of what problem?
Technical problems at all? Any potential problems when you were on the moon?
But not that I'm aware of.
Good, good. Well, obviously you're back, so we don't have to worry about that. But
right.
I guess Buzz was talking about how he had to use his pen to jerry-rig a switch in order to get the capsule, his limb, I guess, back off the face of the moon.
We all had little problems from time to time, of course, if you're talking about equipment failures. Yes, every mission had those. We did, too. But thanks to a well-trained team, both on the ground and in the spacecraft, we were able to get around all of those.
Okay, so here we are, in that case, 36 years later, when you were on the moon. What do you think our technology today would give us in terms of capability if we went back to the moon within 10 years?
Well, we would have, we can do anything we really want to do. The technology, the progress of technology is utterly amazing. I'd like to tell a little story if you give me
sure.
a chance here to help put this in perspective with our, with my audiences and our viewers. I tell the story that my great-grandparents came across from Georgia after our Civil War in the 1870s, covered wagon, pulled by horses, a few head of cattle to start a herd, and a new life in Texas. Railroads weren't complete across the South and the West. Automobiles hadn't been invented. The electric light bulb hadn't been invented. My father was born shortly after the Wright brothers made their first flight, and I went to the moon. From covered wagons to going to the moon in less than 100 years. Now, given the history of humankind and what we know about our past and clear back to, you know, walking on foot, taming camels and horses and all of that, and the explosion of new ideas, new technology that took place, what we call the modern period, from the end of our Civil War in the 1860s to go into the moon, and it hadn't abated yet. We're on an exponential growth curve, an explosive growth in science and technology and knowledge.
And you can imagine, Edgar, a civilization then somewhere out there in the universe that is ahead of us, assuming the same kind of growth curve,
of course,
by, let's say, a million years.
Of course. And if our understanding of the universe is at all even close to being accurate, and there's a lot of questions about our understanding of it.
Sure.
There are millions and billions of galaxies and planets and galaxy clusters, star systems. The idea that we're alone in the universe is, once we now start to understand a little bit about it, is utterly absurd.
What an incredible guy. Edgar Mitchell, dead at the age of 85. Truly missed him. And as I said, he was on the moon in 1971. On his way there, he conducted some experiments, some mind type of telepathy type experiments, truly changed his life forever. He came back and really put together the Noetic Institute. And a lot of great thinkers became part of that. Again, until the day he died, he believed, as he said, 90% certainty that we're being visited by extraterrestrial life. And he kept insisting, though, that he had never seen a UFO, that he was never involved in ETs, but that people high up in government have told him that it is indeed true. And when a guy like that, an astronaut, tells you that, you got to believe it. You absolutely have to believe it. We're going to continue with our very special tribute to some coast-to-coast guests who have departed. Those of you who are listening, some people think that these folks are live guests. No, they are not. You can't talk to them. You can talk to me, but not to them. We'll be back.